KPFT or online at kpft.org, Houston's community station.
KPFT FM HD2, Houston. KPFT.
Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media. We discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
Just a reminder, next election is way out in May 9th, so just make sure you're registered and mail in your application for a mail-in ballot if you're eligible and haven't done so yet. Mm-hmm. Our first story is from CommunityImpact.com. The Tomball City Council approves focus group for Parks, Trails, and Recreation Master Plan. During its February 6th meeting, the Tomball City Council unanimously voted to approve the creation of a focus group for the Parks, Trails, and Recreation Master Plan. The master plan will include a site analysis of the city's existing facilities, community engagement to determine residents' wants and needs, a 5-year action plan, and a 10-year horizon plan, Community Impact previously reported. The focus group will be made up of community members, business owners, and volunteers. City staff recommended people such as Tomball Farmers Market's Amanda Kelly, Tomball Little League President Gene Foster, and business owner Teresa Latsis. Public Works Director Drew Huffman said the focus group will be open to anyone interested in joining. Andrew?
Well, I like that the city is encouraging anyone interested to get involved rather than just business owners. More municipal projects should involve local residents who aren't so-called leaders of the community, but just have an interest in the project area.
It's also worth noting that sometimes people that aren't yet leaders become leaders when they become involved.
Sure.
So there's that. Okay, our next story is also from CommunityImpact.com. Bel Air Police secure new bullet-resistant shields in the event of an active shooter. The Bel Air Police Department will be the recipients of 6 new bullet-resistant shields after Texas officials approved the city's request to fund the tactical equipment. The shields were purchased when the state of Texas made a protective shield grant. Bel Air Chief of Police Onesimo Lopez said acquiring the new shields was a crucial investment to protect the community and to be able to respond to cases of active shooters, such as what occurred in May at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde. The shields, 6 of them, cost $43,800, about $7,300 each, and will be approximately 18 by 32 inches in size, with an integrated viewport so police can see out, and they'll be used by the City of Bel Air's Special Response Team, according to Bel Air Mayor Andrew Freeper. Lopez said the shields can also be deployed during armed barricade suspect scenarios, as well as where first responders might encounter high-powered rifle fire. Andrew?
While it certainly sounds like these shields will be useful in the moment of a mass shooting, this is a pound of cure instead of an ounce of prevention. People don't do things for no reason, and that includes crime, and that includes mass shootings. Some motivators are deep-seated and psychological, hatred and bigotry, for instance, and those require cultural change. But other times, people just need help, whether psychological or material, and can't get it because state governments want to fund riot shields instead of food, housing, or medical assistance. If this money is really meant to stop mass shootings, it should be spent on making sure people have fewer reasons to commit them. But that's not as marketable to conservative voters.
Well, I don't think that this money is earmarked for preventing active shootings as much as it's intended to make police feel and perhaps actually are more protected, so they won't stay out in the hallway while, you know, like 20 kids are being executed.
There's
so
there's
I think
some value.
To the extent that the cops feel safer against a well-armed shooter with a high-velocity weapon, I think that this may help save a human or more than one human's life, and that would make the investment worth it.
There's some value in that. I guess the debate is over where the line should be drawn between funding for when it's happening versus funding for before it happens.
Well, we need both. It's always a matter of apportionment.
Hmm.
Next story, also from communityimpact.com. ERCOT unveils new six-day supply and demand forecast to improve transparency and strengthen Texans' trust in the state power grid. I lack that. The Electric Reliability Council of Texas released a new dashboard with the forecast supply and demand for 6 days. The forecast dashboard provides Texans with an idea of what supply and demand for energy will look like in the future, much like a weather forecast, according to a news release from ERCOT. The new dashboard uses real-time data and projected information on supply and demand from hourly forecasts. It can be found on ERCOT's homepage. There is a link both on my blog and in the article itself, as well as a grid and market conditions site by selecting 6-day forecast below the single-day supply and demand chart. I make fun of ERCOT a lot. They traumatized me enough that I bought solar panels. But this new public forecasting is a good idea. Also, the power outages in Austin were mostly caused by trees knocking down lines, and that's a utility company problem. The trees should be kept severely pruned around power lines, and I can say from experience that when, at the time, HL&P used to trim my trees, they trimmed them enough so I would get annoyed, but they didn't knock down the power lines. Andrew?
This is a good idea, but for it to work, it needs to be trustworthy. No manipulated data, and most forecasts need to come broadly true. Otherwise, it'll just be another ploy to distract from the inadequacy of state Republicans' power policies. I'd also say, I missed a little bit the unreliability joke that you usually trot out.
Oh, yeah, it could be the Energy Unreliability Council of Texas, or it could be the ERCOT reliability. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways I can do that. I also, you know, this question sort of popped into my mind is, what are Texans supposed to do with this forecast? Because
that's,
it's not, you know, like right now, because we didn't have water, and I've been saving now gallon jugs of tap water and have about 7 gallons saved up. And as it happens, my water line was broken by a car a few days ago. And oh, it's no. Like, oh, paranoia pays off because I had 7 gallons of tap water in the house. So, but you can't save electricity when you see that the lines are going to diverge between consumption and availability. So while this is a good idea, I laud it. It's a good idea. I'm just wondering, what will the average Texan be able to do with it?
I will point out, you can save electricity if you buy like large batteries, for example. But
panels, emergency generators, backup generators. But, you know, those are things that require a fair amount of forward looking.
Yeah,
not the kind of thing a 6-day graph will help you with.
Yeah, it's not as easy as filling up a bunch of old milk jugs.
No, it really isn't. Be great if it was.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think it's an interesting step forward. I'm just not sure what I'll do with it when they finally make it happen. Anyway, so the next story is from the Texas Tribune. Texas executes Wesley Ruiz despite ongoing fight over state's use of old lethal injection drugs. Ruiz was convicted in the 2007 shooting death of Dallas Police Senior Corporal Mark Nix after a high-speed chase. On Wednesday evening, Texas executed Ruiz despite the ongoing controversy surrounding the state's use of drugs long past their original expiration dates to kill prisoners. Ruiz, 43, was sentenced to death nearly 15 years ago. In an active legal battle, Ruiz and other condemned prisoners argued the state prison system should not be allowed to continue extending the expiration dates of its execution drugs. They claim the use of old drugs violates the U.S. Constitution's prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment. With fewer pharmacies willing to produce execution drugs, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for years has extended the use-by dates of its existing pentobarbital, the only drug now used in Texas executions, after retesting its potency levels. I'll point out that's a sedative. All it will do is increasingly sedate a prisoner until they're dead. Previous legal battles seeking to halt the practice have failed in court. In the current litigation, Texas's high courts refused to halt a January execution, overriding a lower court's temporary order that the prisons use only new execution drugs until the lawsuit goes to trial in March. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals ruled the lower court could not issue any order that would seemingly cancel an execution. I've come to be against the death penalty on principle. It's something I've evolved on over the decades. I'm not convinced that some people don't deserve it, but I am convinced that the whole process is too flawed to allow it. I've read that as many as 10% of death row inmates may not be guilty of the crime they've been sentenced for, and even one is too many. And while there's no polite way to kill someone, the current system smacks too much of Nazi experimentation. Andrew?
I don't believe that the authority in a society that decides whether someone has done something wrong should be able to also decide to kill someone for what they've done wrong. Because if killing that person turns out to be the wrong thing to do, it would fall to that very same authority that committed the wrongdoing to find itself at fault, which is unlikely. The use of expired drugs for lethal injection is a case in point for this. There is good faith concern that these expired drugs cause pain in what is supposed to be a painless process, and that would be cruel punishment, something prevented by the laws of the authority, in this case, the state and federal governments. But it falls to the state government to decide whether that is an acceptable reason to stop using the expired drugs, which would limit the authority's power to kill offenders. And because the state government has a vested interest in maintaining that power, they have denied it. It's a very clear conflict of interest, but unfortunately, it can only be resolved through action from that authority. That makes resolution difficult, but not impossible. Federal action is a reasonable possibility due to how often the people in charge of the federal government change, but I see virtually no chance of the state government giving up their power to kill people. I see the death penalty as, among other things, a very sobering cautionary tale against giving someone power without having a clear and achievable way to take it away.
The conflict of interest is an interesting point. I don't recall hearing that before, and maybe some lawyer will pick up on it.
I hope so. I do want to add, actually, that I do believe that there are types of harm that you can do to another person that would, you know, it would justify killing somebody for doing that. But I think that whether somebody should die for something or try and be rehabilitated needs to be more of a community decision, needs to be more of a family member's decision, needs to be more of a victim decision rather than an authority decision.
I also want to mention that when they first started using execution drugs to be more theoretically humane, people would joke about the
term safe and effective, I think it was.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to think of, what is it, the FDA, that the FDA was wanting the execution drugs to be safe and effective, and the joke was, well, if you're dead at the end of it, that makes it effective. But I think what we're seeing now is we have to take that seriously, because safe is the other part of that, not just dead, but like dead humanely, quickly, painlessly, and, you know, effectively.
Yeah.
Assuming you're going to kill people with drugs at all. That is kind of the point.
And Texas is kind of falling down on that.
Well, depends on where you stand in the government of Texas, I suppose. They think they're doing a great job. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org. Download with Google Podcasts, which is available from both Android and iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, so I link to full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click on show posts and more at the top of the webpage and find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can also type keywords into the search bar to find older stories. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig, and look for me on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Our next story is from the Texas Tribune. The Rio Grande Valley is at the epicenter of an Alzheimer's spike among Latinos and is now the focus of a new research effort. Compared to other large states, fewer state dollars go to Alzheimer's disease services in Texas. Now, with more national attention on research here, could that change? And the story goes, a stretch of South Texas is struggling with a crisis many parts of the nation could someday face. Cases of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias are climbing, and the state's response has been uneven at best. There is no cure for Alzheimer's, and scientists don't fully understand what causes this devastating form of dementia. But research shows that poor access to health care, lack of education, air pollution, and other social and environmental factors leave people more vulnerable to the disease. All these factors converge in the four counties that make up the Rio Grande Valley, a mostly rural, majority Latino region, where the infrastructure, education, and healthcare systems suffer from decades of neglect. Medicare data shows that people here who are 65 and older are almost twice as likely to be diagnosed with dementia as people in that age group in most other parts of the country, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. In Starr County alone, one of the nation's poorest, nearly one in four older people had Alzheimer's or a related dementia in 2021. That compares to one in 14 nationwide. When it comes to dementia among Mexican Americans, South Texas is at the tip of the spear, said neurologist Sudha Seshadri, who directs the Glenn Biggs Institute for Alzheimer's and Neurodegenerative Diseases at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. About 400,000 Texans suffer from Alzheimer's or related disorders, and the state spends $5 million annually on dementia-specific programs. According to the Alzheimer's Association, it spends $4.5 million a year to fund Alzheimer's research through a consortium of in-state institutions. It also spends $500,000 through the Texas Department of State Health Services on an Alzheimer's disease program, which runs a public education campaign, provides online lists of resources, and collects data. None of that money goes to train caregivers or to provide other services that directly help patients and their families deal with the disease, according to Laura Anton of DSHS, spokesperson. That spending puts Texas, which currently has a $32.7 billion budget surplus that lawmakers will allocate during the current legislative session, far behind the efforts of other large states. Seshadri works with the neuroepidemiologist Gladys Maestre, a professor at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley School of Medicine, to better understand Alzheimer's and related conditions in Mexican-American communities. In 2021, the National Institute on Aging appointed them co-directors of a new federally funded Alzheimer's Disease Research Center that has facilities at both of their universities. Together, they are looking at why so many cases are concentrated in South Texas and what, if anything, can be done to bring down the numbers. Research in Latino communities could unlock clues to these diseases that would help people of all ethnicities, said Sid O'Brien, a neuroscientist at the University of North Texas Health Science Center. They really need shorter names for these places. Latinos make up 19% of the U.S. population, and some studies show they have 1.5 times greater risk for dementia than white people without Hispanic ancestry. But so little research has been done within the Latino community that scientists don't understand why. Lack of access to health care is likely one of the biggest contributors to dementia in the valley because diabetes, heart disease, and other health conditions increase the risk of Alzheimer's and related dementias. The federal government classifies all four of the valley's counties as medically underserved, meaning they don't have enough primary care doctors, dentists, and other medical professionals. Finding specialists, including neurologists, who can help diagnose and treat Alzheimer's is especially tough for rural residents. Texas, one of 11 states that has refused to expand Medicaid, also has the highest percentage of uninsured people in the nation at 18%. The problem is acute in the valley, where roughly half of adults under 65 live without health insurance, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Researchers hope their work in the valley will give them a deeper understanding of the factors that increase the risk for Alzheimer's and other dementias. Certain genes may contribute, but so can circumstances that people can change or avoid. Some studies suggest literacy alone may have a powerful protective effect. In Texas, O'Brien found that Mexican-American communities can show early signs of dementia almost a decade before non-Hispanic whites. He is investigating how two non-genetic factors may be involved, the overall socioeconomic status of a community, and the prevalence of diabetes, hypertension, and other health problems. The rest of the article goes on to mostly discuss increases in funding and of government interest in researching causes of dementia in the state, and specifically why parts of the valley seem to have higher incidences of Alzheimer's among Latinos. I have to say it sounds roughly like a scientific experiment, which is unfortunate. I remember years ago reading that there were also so-called hotspots of birth defects in the valley. I don't recall reading much more about it, which probably means nothing was publicly identified as a cause specifically. But one thing is always true. Poverty and political powerlessness always go together. Andrew?
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of on that note, Texas doesn't fund Alzheimer's services for the same reason that Texas hasn't expanded Medicaid. In order to keep power, capitalism needs to keep the majority of people in a position where they are willing to be exploited. And Republicans are among the most ruthless of capitalists. If more money was spent on social programs, people would be less desperate. And if people were less desperate, they'd be willing to put up with a lot less at work. Now, I'm not suggesting that Alzheimer's spending is going to enable people to quit terrible jobs in one fell swoop, but it's part of a larger policy that's motivated by greed. The only way to counter that policy is either to get a different set of people in power or for the masses to obstruct or threaten to obstruct business enough through striking or other industrial action that their demands for more social care are met, because the alternative is the action keeps going until one side is totally penniless and or dead. That's a lose-lose proposition for the people at the top who profit off the hard work of the people at the bottom. Unfortunately, often the people at the top are too stubborn to see it that way.
Okay, our next story is from WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. It's an interesting article on a topic that I heard about once, and it made me curious as to why it isn't discussed more. And as we go into the article, you'll see what I mean. It's called, If Biden Calls Debt Ceiling Unconstitutional, What Next? Last week, the author of this article, Michael Miropol, delivered a commentary that began with the assertion that the debt ceiling law was in direct conflict with the Constitution and ended with the following recommendation for President Biden. Quote, if the Republicans refuse to raise the debt ceiling, Biden should say the debt ceiling is unconstitutional and refuse to abide by it. He can then order the Treasury to borrow money over and above the debt ceiling. Let the Republicans sue. By the time the suit gets to the Supreme Court, the Democrats will have swept the extremist Republicans out of power in the 2024 elections, unquote. This was last week's argument. And again, a quote, Biden should say that the debt ceiling law is unconstitutional because it conflicts with Section 4 of the 14th Amendment and with the original rules prescribed for the Congress in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. Which reads, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts. The 14th Amendment emphasizes that point when it says, the public debt of the United States is not to be questioned. In short, when you combine both of these sections of the Constitution, we find the debt ceiling law is in direct conflict. If the Republicans refuse to raise the debt ceiling, Biden should say the debt ceiling is unconstitutional and refuse to abide by it. He should then order the Treasury to continue borrowing money to meet the obligations that Congress had already voted for. Now, this legal analysis has never been tested because the U.S. government has never actually gotten to the point of default, though we did get close back in 2011, as the author of this piece noted in the longer written version of last week's commentary, which I have included a link to. If we begin the discussion where things were left in last week's article, the first question is, would the Biden administration take such a drastic step? Would the Justice Department think that the argument presented about the Constitution would work? Many lawyers think it would have a fighting chance. Obviously, the Biden administration won't even think of this until the Republicans show they're really trying to force a default. The reason the administration might consider this is because a default would be too much of a disaster for them to let it happen. Yet, allowing the Republicans to hold the debt ceiling hostage just encourages them to do it next time. And even the coming close back in 2011 did lead to a temporary downgrade of U.S. debt instruments, which ended up costing money as the interest the U.S. paid went up. I seem to recall that was tens of billions of dollars for no good reason. Going on. So once we get to the Biden administration deciding to call the debt ceiling unconstitutional, how does that action get into the courts? The first interesting issue would be, who would have standing to sue the Biden administration for blowing through the debt ceiling? The idea of legal standing involves being able to show that you have some reason to sue. You have to prove you were injured by the person or entity you are suing. Perhaps members of Congress could have standing because the Biden administration would be disregarding a law. But they could not file as individuals, but only as representatives of the institution. Would every Republican in the House vote to empower the Speaker to sue on behalf of the House? I think we can be pretty certain that no Democrat would vote to force a default. Would every Republican? So, some individual members of Congress might sue, but why would they have standing? How would they be able to claim they had been harmed by the Biden administration's blowing through the debt ceiling? It would be extremely hard to claim they had been harmed when the Biden administration disregarded the debt ceiling. That's because breaching the debt ceiling does not add a penny to the deficit that hasn't already been voted for by Congress. In fact, many individuals could make strong cases that they, as individuals, would be harmed by the failure of the Biden administration to spend money Congress has already appropriated. Instead, the issue might get to the courts from another direction. A law professor friend of the writer suggested that creditors, such as banks, insurance companies, even individuals, might ask a court for a declaratory judgment that money borrowed in defiance of the debt ceiling must be honored just like all U.S. government debt. That would, in effect, ask a court to validate what the Biden administration was doing. They would have standing because they want guarantees that the bonds they own will keep their value, something that would definitely not happen, if the U.S. were to default. The article then goes on to some theoreticals about how the Supreme Court might act or react depending on certain internal outcomes. And the story goes on, the important thing to hope for is that the Biden administration will be willing to make this their last resort tactic to prevent a default. The idea of them yielding to the hostage takers is too awful to contemplate. There are a few months before push will come to shove. Right now, Biden has asked Speaker McCarthy to, quote, show me your budget so they can actually have something to talk about. After March 9th, when the president's proposed budget is released, the writer of this article will undoubtedly have lots of things to say. Andrew?
Well, I'm very impressed by this argument. Maybe I shouldn't be, considering it comes from an economics professor. Then again, it comes from an economics professor. I kid. I find the points about who could sue really interesting, though I do wonder if Republicans in the court system might put party over law and let a suit without standing advance anyway. I think the professor's argument is weakened by brushing over the politics, though. Mike observed pre-show that any lawsuit would likely be on an expedited docket because of potentially important implications. I agree. If the case is heard quickly, it could reach the Supreme Court well before November 2024, and who knows how it would affect voters. If the case is lost, it would lock this particular tactic away, but it may also have farther-reaching policy consequences we can't see yet. I think the professor also glosses over the additional political work necessary for the Democrats to win in 2024, and thus earn short-term immunity from a loss in court. The Biden administration would have to use that open debt space wisely. Guns and bombs would not help them win. The Democrats would have to pull their party together and come up with some serious assistance for the working class to spend that money on in order to get undecided, apathetic, and unregistered voters to turn out and vote for them. The Republican House would limit what they could get passed alone, but expanding current programs as riders to larger legislation might be an easier sell, especially if strategic deals can be made with centrist Republicans. Just pushing back the debt ceiling won't mean an election victory, and whether that push is politically risky will be a major factor in whether Biden tries it.
I think an interesting factor here also is that the debt ceiling law was passed around 1919. It was related to First World War debt that the United States had created. And it's really kind of interesting to wonder why in 100 years this has never been challenged in court. And after thinking about it for a while and thinking about it while Andrew was making his points, I began to think that, you know, until the turn of the 21st century, it had never really been much of an issue. It had been a clean sheet document that had been passed more or less unanimously, or at least by the party in power, mm-hmm. and it was routine. It's really only like in the last 15 or 20 years that this has become a hostage-taking exercise. Mm. It may be that which finally ultimately brings this law to court. I will also note that I have an unusual number of references here because there was really an awful lot to read and kind of consider. So I've got something like 10 or 12 references if you want to do your own exploration. Okay, you are listening to Thinkwing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's Community Media, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org, download with Google Podcasts, something I recommend, and it's available from both the Android and iPhone app stores, or you can visit archive.kpft.org for previous versions of the show. KPFT is Houston's community media with about 100 show titles. To do that means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for Thinkwing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, perhaps ours, and the amount of your donation, whether large, small, or in between, and you may qualify for a lovely thank you gift. And tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows. Spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. Our next story is from CNBC.com. The U.S. is absolutely behind on supply chain independence from China, Biden advisor says. The U.S. has some rapid catching up to do if it is to secure the reliability of its supply chain and its independence from competitors like China, a top White House advisor admitted this week. China controls roughly 60% of the world's production of rare earth minerals and materials, according to a recent report by Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. Those resources include lithium, cobalt, nickel, graphite, manganese, and other rare earth elements crucial for making things like electric vehicles, batteries, computers, and household goods. They're also essential for renewable technology like solar panels and wind turbines, which are central in the U.S.'s attempt at an energy transition away from fossil fuels. As just one example, China refines 95% of the world's manganese, a chemical element used in batteries and steel manufacturing, despite mining less than 10% of its global supply. For the U.S., whose relations with China can currently be described as tense at best, this poses several security risks were China to decide to weaponize that market dominance at any point. The COVID-19 pandemic and the Russia-Ukraine war have also highlighted the fragility of the global supply chain. I hate to say that this has been a predictable strategic economic outcome for decades, but it has. This is like the U.S. being so demobilized after World War I that we went into the war without enough guns to train new troops, without enough helmets, and with an inadequate air force. Folks who complain about how expensive our military is today weren't alive during the pre-World War II era. But the issue now isn't capability, it's capacity. Do we have enough industrial capacity that we can expand to fill our own needs in a crisis? Look at the predicament the Russians have found themselves in, and they were strategically stupid enough to start a major war on their own borders in spite of it. We have stockpiles of strategic supplies. But the Russians have learned how quickly a high-intensity war consumes stockpiles. And even though we have about a dozen countries helping us supply Ukraine, so have we. I think it's been a strategic eye-opener. This story is part of that belated recognition. Andrew?
Well, my concern, as I've said before on this show, is more with civilians than troops. If some idiot in government pulls us into a war we don't need, and it cuts off our trade with China, there's going to be a lot more hardship, and a lot of people are going to be at risk of starving. In order to avoid that, I think the U.S. needs to stop favoring multinational corporations that outsource their manufacturing to countries where they can pay officials to keep wages and labor rights depressed there. Government financial support to businesses in the U.S. should come with the condition that a supermajority of their operational expansion happens in the U.S. That would create jobs, increase competition, leading to more affordable living for consumers, and help rebuild the U.S. ability to supply itself.
Practicality and legality of some of your suggestions aside, I think I'm in fundamental agreement with your premise. Okay, from BusinessInsider.com, the U.S. military says China now has more ICBM launchers than it does, but the U.S. still has the nuclear edge. Rather, let me rephrase the emphasis on that title. The U.S. military says China now has more ICBM launchers than the U.S. does, but the U.S. still has the nuclear edge, I think is a little clearer. General Anthony Cotton, commander of the U.S. Strategic Command, sent memos to both the House and House Armed, rather to both the Senate and House Armed Services Committees in late January, detailing the status of China's ICBM activities as of October 2022. The number of land-based fixed and mobile ICBM launchers in China, and that'll get defined later what launchers are, exceeds the number of ICBM launchers in the United States, Cotton wrote in letters sent to respective committees on January 26th and obtained by Insider. U.S. Strategic Command, or STRATCOM, is responsible for nuclear operations, command, control, and communications. Cotton added that the number of ICBMs in China's active inventory, quote, has not exceeded the number of ICBMs in the active inventory of the United States. This is where it starts to sound a little confusing, so we will clarify. He also said that, quote, the number of nuclear warheads equipped on such missiles of China has not exceeded the number of nuclear warheads equipped on such missiles of the United States, unquote. The Wall Street Journal first reported the unclassified information distributed by STRATCOM to Congress earlier on Tuesday. U.S. officials and experts told the outlet many of China's launches are just empty silos, and officials noted that STRATCOM's warning about China's launcher advantage doesn't include two legs of the nuclear triad where the U.S. has a distinct advantage, long-range bombers and submarines. That said, China's edge in land-based fixed and mobile launchers does bring Beijing closer to fielding a more robust ICBM capacity. The report also predicted the continued expansion of the Chinese nuclear arsenal. It estimated that China had at least 400 operational nuclear warheads in its stockpile and was on pace to beef that figure up to 1,500 by 2035. By contrast, the U.S. has well over 5,000 warheads in its arsenal, second in the world only to Russia. To counter the nuclear threat posed by China and also by Russia, the U.S. is working on an expensive new missile to replace its current ICBMs, which I will personally note, I think, go back to like the 1970s, so they're not exactly new hardware, though it would take years before new missiles become operational. The U.S. military also recently unveiled a new nuclear-capable stealth bomber, and work is underway on a new class of ballistic missile submarine. So you might have guessed I kind of have a particular interest in international and to some extent military affairs on a lay level. It's come up several times on this show in past weeks that, in my opinion, a geopolitically multipolar world is a more dangerous place. This story is telling us that in a different way. First, some historical context based partly on research and partly on my recollections. In the late 1950s and early 60s, there was talk in the U.S. of a missile gap between the U.S. and USSR. In response, the U.S. hurriedly built new missiles, I believe it was the Minuteman I at the time, and also developed something called MIRVs, multiple independently targeted re-entry vehicles. This enabled the U.S. to put up to half a dozen or more warheads on a single missile. This ultimately led to a first Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, or SALT, between the U.S. and the USSR that led to the USSR having more launchers than the U.S., which is to say ways to launch missiles and missiles themselves, but not more deliverable warheads. There was SALT I and SALT II, and then the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, START I and START II. I have a link to a little of that. START II expired in 2002 when the Russians withdrew from the treaty when the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty expired, but that's another part of the story. What enabled SALT and START to be negotiated in this instance, at least in my opinion, was a relatively simple two-party negotiation. Very complex, but relatively simple. Other nuclear powers at the time were too small to be much concerned with in negotiations. The parties were concerned with a massive first strike by one side, leaving a fearsome second strike capability surviving. This was what became known as MAD, for Mutual Assured Destruction. Returning to the story, the Chinese may have more launchers than the U.S. or may not, launchers being silos, which may or may not be empty, mobile trucks with launch hardware, which may or may not have missiles to put on them. So that's what they're talking about when they talk about missiles versus launchers, ways of launching the missiles. But without MIRVs, the U.S. can still have more deliverable warheads, which is how the U.S. can have fewer missiles but more deliverable warheads. Now consider a three-party situation where two parties can gang up on a third party, theoretically, totally annihilating any realistic danger of massive retaliation. In a world with no salts, no starts, and three parties trying to come up with a way to protect themselves from two others, the world is going to be a far more dangerous place than during the Cold War, and defense budgets are likely to get much, much larger all around. Andrew?
Well, I think the core flaw in your analysis, I respect the historical information that you're bringing in, both from your own perspective and from what's publicly available, but I think the core flaw in your analysis is the idea that two parties ganging up on a third would prevent massive retaliation. I think history has shown us that the more states are involved in a conflict, the bigger the conflict gets. Consider World War I, which was aggravated from a relatively small-scale conflict between two nations into an entire world war just through defensive pacts and alliances. Most nuclear-capable nations in the world have pledged nuclear support to either the U.S., Russia, or an ally of one of those nations. If China becomes the third great nuclear power, this won't change. Even if China breaks its promises of nuclear support to Russia, it will still have promises from smaller countries that it can rely on. The details would change, but the overall situation would remain the same. If one nuke is launched, all the others will quickly follow. Global thermonuclear war. Even if one or more nations choose not to launch in such a scenario, the environmental, social, and economic consequences would still be devastating and likely lead to the collapse of any remaining governments. Therefore, mutually assured destruction would remain intact, and the world would be no more dangerous than it is today. Now, I'm not saying I like more nuclear weapons or even means to launch them existing in the world. I've mentioned before on the show how I think a peace maintained by tension is actually more dangerous than occasional or even frequent small-scale conflict, because that tension can snap so easily, and all the hell it holds back would rain down at once. I believe it's ridiculous that humanity maintains massive stocks of weapons that could wipe out all life on Earth, and I support mutual denuclearization policies and agreements. But to think that a country having more nuclear weapons is a threat to some nations but not others is just not realistic, and fear-mongering because a U.S. adversary is trying to close their own nuclear gap with the U.S. only helps warhawks and the military-industrial complex.
I think Andrew has evolved on politics over the years, but to move on, it's the military's job to analyze prospective military threats, to inform civilian authority about them, and then let civilian authority make policy and budget decisions. Now, there's a lot in what Andrew says that I agree with or don't disagree with, but national leadership sometimes do stupid things that are ultimately against their own best interest. And again, Russia invading Ukraine is a good example.
That's true. I just don't necessarily think that risk will significantly increase if the world becomes more multipolar.
I think it comes down to not necessarily what's right or smart or logical. I think it's if someone thinks it's right or smart or logical. And sure, there are a lot of very stupid things that have been done because they have been advised by very smart people that they should do them. Or very stupid people in command have told very smart people to do them, and the smart people just shrug and go, well, orders are orders.
Or like in the Dr. Strangelove example, some smaller official starts something using the limited power they have and draws larger or people higher up the food chain into their stupid decision.
Interesting little bit of trivia that I believe is accurate, that sometime back in maybe the 1970s or 80s, the U.S. was so concerned about a nuclear launch accident in the Soviet Union that they actually, I'm going to say, either gave or allowed to share U.S. command and control technology, so they had tighter control of their launch codes.
I think I've heard that. And yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And I wish there was more of that sort of thing, to be honest.
Well, there may be. And I suppose sometimes there is. It just, you know, we don't necessarily hear much about it. Okay.
I think it's about time for a break.
Yeah, and I'm just deciding which break to read. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. It's a very weird thing driving in your car and suddenly hearing your show on the air, and you're just driving your car. Just saying. We do heavily excerpt every story on the show, which is why we include links to full articles on the show posts and more page at thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station. Website's pretty much updated these days. You can also catch up on your favorite shows on the archive, and you can help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738. It's like a jingle, 713-526-5738, and just hit option one, and you will then be taken through the process. We're also on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and I am on Twitter at Think Wing Radio, and Andrew does have his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's Dominate, E-Y-E, on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Do we need more stupid jokes on this show?
I always welcome stupid jokes, personally.
Do we make enough stupid jokes, or do we need to sort of dig deeper into this stupid joke theory?
I mean, I think we're a little bit concerned with feeling or appearing smart on this show. Maybe that's getting in the way of our stupid joke production.
I believe there was a joke on the game/series The Last of Us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it went something like, do you know that diarrhea is inheritable?
Really?
It runs through your genes.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's pretty good for a show about, you know, the end of the world as we know it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've been putting that stuff in. I have to respect it.
Yep.
Okay, next story is from BBC.com. How the U.S. Marines are being reshaped for the China threat. The U.S. military commitment to the Pacific was underlined in a White House meeting between the leaders of the U.S. and Japan. But behind the scenes, this renewed focus on Asia has sparked a fierce debate within one of its most fabled military forces, writes defense analyst Jonathan Marcus. A bitter family row has erupted in one of the U.S. military's most hallowed institutions, the U.S. Marine Corps. A host of its former senior commanders are lining up to attack current leadership over plans for its reinvention. At issue is a plan to adapt the service for a potential conflict against China, a plan dubbed Force Design 2030. I have to say, I've said before, I think it's adorable that they think they have until 2030 to get this done. Almost from its inception, this plan has been under attack, with a cohort of retired generals taking the unusual approach of going to the press to air their frustrations. Retired senior officers have been meeting regularly, speaking at seminars and think tanks, and devising their own alternative plan, which they see as a disaster. Which they see as a disaster for the Marine Corps' future. One prominent critic is the former U.S. Navy Secretary and former Senator for Virginia, Jim Webb, who served as a Marine officer in the Vietnam War and ran for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2015. Writing in the Wall Street Journal, he described Force Design 2030 as, quote, insufficiently tested and intrinsically flawed. He warned that the plan, quote, raised serious questions about the wisdom and long-term risk of dramatic reductions in force structure, weapons systems, and manpower levels in units that would take steady casualties in most combat scenarios. So what is it that has got them all so upset? Launched in 2020 by the Marine Corps Commandant General David H. Berger, the plan is intended to equip the Marines for a potential conflict with China in the Indo-Pacific rather than counterinsurgency wars like Iraq and Afghanistan. The new plan sees the Marines as fighting dispersed operations across chains of islands. Units will be smaller, more spread out, but packing a much bigger punch through a variety of new weapons systems. Huge amphibious landings like in World War II or massive deployments on land like in Iraq will probably be things of the past. Most unpopular is the plan to cut back on foot soldiers and give up all of the Marines' tanks. Such proposals have led some critics to feel the Corps is turning its back on its past. Its traditional role as America's military first responder, capable of taking on disparate challenges around the globe, is what critics believe could be compromised by the new plan with its clear focus upon China and the Indo-Pacific. So what exactly is in the plan? Some infantry battalions, basically foot soldiers, would be cut. Around three-quarters of its towed artillery batteries would be replaced by long-range rocket systems. Several helicopter squadrons are being cut, and giving up all its tanks. Money for the new weapon systems, totaling $15.8 billion, are to be funded by the cuts, which amount to some $18.2 billion. In addition to the new rocket artillery systems, there are to be new anti-shipping missiles that can be fired from land, and new unmanned aerial systems. This is all basically learning from what's going on in Ukraine right now, I think. Certainly it's been enhanced. Going on, the goal is to equip and train the Marine Corps for a new kind of warfare that the fighting in Ukraine has already prefigured. Many commentators insist that change is essential if the Marines are to face up to the challenges of the modern battlefield. While the withdrawal of the Marines' tanks has drawn particular criticism, Dr. Frank Hoffman, himself a former Marine officer and now a distinguished research fellow at the U.S. National Defense University, believes it is the right course. There will still be plenty of armored vehicles, he argues, just not the heavy tanks and their supporting cast of refuelers. It's an adaptation to cover a deeper area with a more accurate mix of firepower, such as we are seeing in Ukraine. The Corps has used its aviation element to have this range in the past, and now it will have a mix of traditional artillery and a family of missiles that will increase the lethality and range of fire support. These are all steps that many would say are justified by the lessons from Ukraine. Force Design 2030 is very much an evolving program. There have already been changes, and there will be more. Amphibious shipping will play a key role here. And as Nick Childs, Senior Fellow for Naval Forces and Maritime Security at the IISS in London, explains, very long names, new kinds of ships are going to be needed. He says, just relying on their traditional large amphibious ships would leave them too vulnerable to the kinds of modern weaponry that they are likely to face. So new kinds of smaller ships in greater numbers will be vital so that the Marine Corps can operate in a more agile, dispersed way. But getting more ships is not going to be easy. Smaller ships can be built quickly and in a wide range of shipyards, but not necessarily at the pace needed. The U.S. Navy also needs significant numbers of new warships, and it is far from clear that there are the funds or the shipyard capacity needed. It's the age-old problem of matching strategic priorities to resources, and the crisis in Ukraine underlines that old threats can reappear just as a force is trying to focus itself in an entirely new direction. This is a historically interesting problem for a military. Persist in fighting the last war or prepare for the next one? And can you safely predict the next one? After all, it's said that no battle plan survives contact with the enemy. Andrew and I have talked on the show before that the war in Ukraine gives some foresight into how future wars may be fought. The roles of tanks are going to change, the roles of missiles and light artillery and drones. Every military in the world is watching what's going on there and reevaluating and maybe a little bit panicking. And the world's militaries are analyzing the tactics, strategies, and counter strategies being used by both sides. One thing you can be sure of, the next war, the next war, won't be fought quite like the Ukraine war. Lessons learned will change that. There's an interesting contradiction between this story and some others I've seen. Force Design 2030 is, by definition, a strategy for designing a military to fight effectively in the Pacific by 2030. Some military people have suggested that if the U.S. and China fight a war, it might be more like by 2027 or maybe 2025, which would make sense for the Chinese because we may be at our weakest point by then in this rebuilding process. We actually talked about this, I think, last week. There are two factors at play here. China's coming demographic implosion, affecting the number of personnel they need as foot soldiers and to operate their equipment, and the realignment and rebuilding of U.S. forces, which might create a short-term capability gap. I don't like to predict, but I want to make a couple of speculations. If the U.S. and China don't go to war by 2030, we probably won't within our lifetimes. Also, I think it's entirely possible that by 2030, one of the outcomes of the Russo-Ukraine war may be the resumption, interestingly, of a bipolar geopolitical world but with the U.S. and China, with Russia becoming a vassal state of China, essentially China's U.K., if you will. Andrew?
Well, it seems the critics of Force Design 2030 are largely taking a generalist position. We don't know exactly what the next military misadventure will be, so it makes some sense to be as prepared as we can for as many things as we can. If I was in charge of U.S. defense policy, pause for raucous laughter from Mike, I would be...
Sorry.
I would probably also lean more... I would probably also lean more towards the generalist approach, though with a focus on actual defense of U.S. and allied territory rather than any first strike or expansion preparedness. I think we should also consider the cultural and political effects in the U.S. that will result from the war machine changing its targets so physically. It's well documented that the U.S. news media made very noticeable changes when the U.S. began its wars in the Middle East. Pop culture shifted as well to reflect and reinforce the paranoia and manufactured consent that the public had been settled into. Government assistance programs lost funding in favor of defense spending, and establishment politicians competed over who was the bigger warmonger. I don't know if I like to predict or not, but I don't think it's a stretch to speculate that the same things will happen again, but with a twist, now that the DOD is focusing on China.
Well, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. I think that it's good to question sources, because the military taking action or the civilian leadership leaning toward taking action, and then the media reporting on this action may be coming and here are the reasons for it. There is a chicken and egg kind of aspect to that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the Spanish-American War, the sinking of the Maine, blamed on the Spanish, bombing it in Havana Harbor, and all of a sudden the United States is up in arms and takes over most of Spain's remaining empire. And historically, it turns out some decades later, actually, when they were able to dive and explore the wreck, it turns out that the explosion came from the inside and not the outside. Hmm. In other words, it was probably an accident in the powder storage.
Hmm.
Sometimes now that war, you could argue, was caused by what they called at the time yellow journalism, basically really beating the drums for warfare. So, yeah, we always have to be alert to which is coming first, the drum beating or the actual provocation that might take us to war.
And that's why independent media like this radio station is so very important. Please donate to KPFT.
And that wasn't even a paid advertisement, because technically we're not paid.
Yeah, we're not paid at all for
this. We're not paid at all. So if we get 100% raise, we're getting, if you multiply by zero. Anyway, I would like to think this was an interesting show. I hope you will have thought so, too.
Yeah,
you've been listening to Thinkwing Radio with Mike on. I'm sorry, I cut you off. I am always happy to take praise, and I'm sorry I interrupted it.
That's all right. Yeah, I think we've got a very interesting and wide-ranging collection of stories here. There's some historical information we've imparted that some of our listeners may not know. And I hope, as always, that our listeners did find it very interesting and engaging. And by the way, if you have any comments or questions or suggestions for us, you can email us at thinkwingradio@msn.com.
Thank you so much for adding that little extra bit. I love to hear from people. Okay, and you have been listening to Thinkwing Radio with Mike Koenig on Houston's community media, KPFT 90.1 FM HD2. My co-host and indispensable editor and laugher at my jokes and set up for my jokes, and occasionally I play straight man to him, is Andrew Ferguson. I hope you all found this interesting. I'd look forward to any comments you might have, and look forward to seeing you again next week. Y'all take care.
See you later.
Can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late.
This is DJ Tom Albright coming at you with the Jazz Latino HD show every Tuesday from 5 to 6 p.m. with Latin Jazz and Jazz Latin, followed by an hour of hot salsa dura made for your dancing shoes from 6 to 7 p.m. every Tuesday. And if that's not enough, the Jazz Latino HD show is repeated every Thursday from 10 a.m. to 12 noon. All that on Houston's community station, KPFT HD. D2, the veritably vital virtual radio source via the electron waves on the internet. Just go to kpft.org and scroll down. On the right side is the button to listen to HD2, or go to archive.kpft.org to listen anytime, 24/7.